I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Michelle Schwarzy, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're discussing her 2020 book, Recognizing Resentment, Sympathy, Injustice, and Liberal Political Thought, from Cambridge University Press. Her research is on moral psychology and the history of political economy, especially in 18th century moral and political theory. She has published several articles on these topics. Okay, first of all, Michelle Schwarzy, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks. It's so great to be here, Jeff.
Michelle, I love the book. It was a great sort of trip through modern political thoughts, especially on these Anglo thinkers that you examine on the theme of resentment, and not just a good exercise in the history of political thought, but also a really interesting application to contemporary liberalism on this notion of resentment, justified resentment. So congratulations on the book. Let me ask, first of all, what the motivation was for you to write the book in the first place?
Well, I think like a lot of first books, this began its life as a dissertation. And I got really interested in graduate school and working on emotions and or passions, especially in 18th century political law, political thought. I did a lot of my work and a lot of my research outside of the book is on Adam Smith. And so I was really interested in the role that emotions tend to play in our moral lives. And so wrote a dissertation about that and enlightened motives and passions and their relationship to justice. And then kept working on it more and more post-graduate school in my postdoc and as an assistant, I realized that I was interested in one kind of passion in particular, rather than the gamut of them, and that was resentment and its really fascinating connection to justice, because it seems both on the one hand to cause a lot of injustice and yet also to have this really interesting link or clear link to motivating a respect for rights or a concern with injustice. That I wanted to think more about and sort of work through a little bit more. And I'll say also, when I started work on this topic, resentment was not as much of a passion in the public debate or in the contemporary political debate as it is today. You know, I think it's really ubiquitous in contemporary politics in a way that, say, in 2010, it was not as much. And so part of the revisions of the book developed alongside that. And it was helpful to me, I think, to think through the ways that resentment has contemporary political meaning alongside this interesting sort of historical account.
Yeah, that's great. I want to definitely get back to the contemporary side of things to see if your tune has changed since when you started the project. But yeah, I mean, just to get to the thesis of the book, I mean, the book is a vindication of this passion, right? So you're examining, you know, in part this is a book about the passions in liberalism, and one passion in particular, that of resentment. And so it's a vindication of it against what, you know, against critics. So maybe you could say just right off the bat, I mean, in general, what is the case for resentment? How can liberalism benefit from it?
Yeah, so you're right. I think that is the aim of the book, is to vindicate a certain kind of resentment as a critical passion for liberalism. And when I say liberalism, especially in terms of the purpose of the book overall, I really understand it as, you know, modern liberalism kind of defined by Judith Sklar pretty succinctly as the set of political ideologies interested in securing the conditions for the exercise of political freedom. And so this kind of liberalism often has a few sort of problems with it that I think resentment can address. You often have something like a motivational deficit in liberalism, modern liberalism, especially with respect to justice. there's an absence of a focus on injustice or an absence of a concern with injustice, perhaps because of a focus on rational commitments to justice. And in practice, even though I think a commitment to equality before the law is really central to modern conceptions of liberalism, I think in practice, you often see a weak commitment to that. And so I think resentment can actually address all of these things in a variety of ways. And what I argue in the book is one of its key values really is that resentment centers on injustice or centers us on injustice, that sympathetic resentment, the resentment we feel on behalf of other people, focuses us on trying to sympathize with others who have been wronged or injured, and thinking through what injury occurred, what happened, how we might rectify it, which is a different way of saying that it enlivens us to the plight of the oppressed, whose suffering I think is sometimes obscured in liberal societies. So I think that's one real value of it. I think more obviously, it's also a strong passion. When we think about our resentments, those are really strongly felt emotions that lead us to action, including on behalf of other people who are wronged. And so that's a really powerful way that it can address the motivational deficits. And then finally, a key claim of the book is that the sympathetic resentment that you feel on behalf of another person in part entails this recognition of a victim's relatively equal moral and political standing, and that that provides the kind of affective support for equality before the law that we really need for liberal societies to work. I'd say beyond that, the sort of secondary claim of the book is really that we just do have these kinds of resentments. And so it's perhaps unrealistic of us to think that sort of liberal thinkers to wish that away. And what's more important is to question sort of, if we can't get rid of it, what can we do about it? How might we moderate it, or how might we put it towards beneficial ends?
Yeah, it's an unavoidable passion, right?
Right.
So the task is to channel it rather than assume that it's not going to exist. Yeah, and I like that. I love the claim that you make too about, you know, that resentment implies a certain kind of equality. You don't resent those who you think are lesser than you.
Right.
You know, there's a different emotion connected to that. So it's connected with a certain kind of egalitarian community. I wanted to just push just at the very beginning, and this may betray my own kind of general reaction to resentment, but just in the sense, resentment seems to me to, you know, it implies, I mean, there is a sympathetic character to resentment, right? You're resenting on behalf of an oppressed group, but you also resent, the other half of that is you're resenting somebody, right? You're resenting another group. And I just wonder how that squares with, you could say, just liberalism's tradition of seeking a kind of peace. I mean, even if you go back to Hobbes, right, like as this kind of originary proto-liberal figure, that there's a worry that sits at the heart of liberalism about just social disorder and the need for the kind of channel the desires in order to produce peace, and you know, these diverse societies that people get angry with one another. So I wonder how you think about, you know, the clear motivational problem in justice that resentment is a solution to, with, I guess, this other, you know, central feature of liberalism that has as its end the pursuit of peace, which they seem to be in tension with one another.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, it honestly brings to mind Martin Luther King in the letter to Birmingham Jail, and this sort of criticism of white moderates in that letter as loving order more than justice, right? And this is, I think, often a criticism of various parts of the liberal tradition, that if you have a commitment to what you said was peace, but really order and stability over justice, or really concerns for injustice, then is that a political theory that should be preferable, right? Or does that address concerns of injustice? And I think in part it's how you think about liberalism and what its primary commitments are. So if you do identify it with Hobbes as sort of the outset of the tradition, then definitely we see, right, where the origins of a commitment to order or political stability over something like a concern with what might be ultimately just is, because, right, in Leviathan, any law that's a law is just, right, as long as it's made by the sovereign. Now, there's a difference between good laws and just, or bad laws and good laws and just laws, but any law that's a law that's made by the sovereign is just. So I think, again, I'll bring up Shklar, since she's someone that's in the background of a lot of this book and has influenced me a lot. You know, she explicitly says that she doesn't want to start the liberal tradition with Hobbes for that reason, because there isn't a concern fundamentally with injustice or with ensuring those individuals are able to exercise freedom for all. So I think if your liberalism is one that isn't solely committed to order, but rather actually preserving freedom for all or ensuring freedom for all, then resentment is going to be something useful for it. If you're simply concerned with resentment's tendency to lead to tumult in an individual's psyche, or perhaps it's, let's say, it's volatility, right? Which is really what I think that our knee-jerk reaction is to it, that it seems like such a uncertain emotion. We don't know which way it can go. Then I think those concerns are going to predominate if order is the primary concern. But I don't think that liberalism or all liberalisms need to have order as their sole and primary concern.
Yeah, that seems right to me. I mean, you're used to the term tumult, reminding me of Machiavelli, who,
yep,
you know, is another proto-modern or proto-liberal figure. I mean, you could see that, you could take his account of the conflict among the humors in a society as a kind as sort of vindicating your point here, as an early version of, you know, that the plebeian resentment for the patrician class in Rome was actually beneficial for the common good, right? It's not. So you have, in a way, you could say, two different kinds of liberal, you know, traditions within liberalism: one that emphasizes more the rationalistic pursuit of peace and quietude, and the other one that really tries to amp up the the checks and balances among the different sectors of society. I have anything on that, but yeah.
Right. Or I think even maybe more than two traditions, right? I think Duncan Bell's work on this sort of Helena Rosenblatt's recent book on the lost history of liberalism. I hope we're not to the point where it means so much that it means nothing, but I think there are a lot of different diverse strands of liberalism. And the one that I am particularly interested in is one that is, you know, these Scottish thinkers that I talk about, which I'm sure we'll discuss, are all sort of early advocates for, you know, a liberal economic order that promotes political stability and economic stability. They all have various kinds of concerns with too much political instability, like revolution versus reform. And yet they also have these other central concerns with justice, I think, a liberal conception of justice, but with justice rather than just with order.
Yeah, good. So I wanted to drill down just a little bit in the notion of resentment itself, because there are other, I guess, sort of related emotions that one might think of. You know, anger comes to mind, or Martha Nussbaum had a book about anger, I guess, not too long ago, or indignation. Or I think that what struck me as closest in a certain way was, you know, Plato's account of Thumos in the Republic, where you have a sort of this account of spirit that is just sort of outraged by injustice. We all know the sort of passages. So is there do you see resentment as, you know, how are they sort of similar to or different from these other kind of emotions?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I'm glad that you bring up Thumos, because I agree. I think of all of these kind of similar passions, resentment is the most connected to Thumos precisely because of that intimate connection with justice or with injustice, really. I think generally, and I talk about this a lot in the book, you can distinguish it from anger proper because it is more easily felt on others' behalf, because it can call for a proportionate response and it can call for a nonviolent response. Those are broadly speaking ways you can distinguish it from anger, even though it is immediately related. But I think really the key difference, and this comes out in the development of the argument for the book, is that it is deliberation, essentially. That if you deliberate about why you're angry, then you might become resentful. But generally, anger is not something that includes any kind of reflection or deliberation about the injury done, about any kind of standard of propriety or appropriateness. It's just kind of a immediate or knee-jerk emotional response to a phenomenon, right? And in fact, Joseph Butler, one of the key thinkers that I talk about in the book, actually calls both resentments and anger different types of anger. He calls resentment deliberate anger as compared to sudden anger being being anger proper. And I think that's a nice way of getting at this big difference, that resentment actually entails even just basic resentment, not the more intricate types that I discuss or defend in the book, like sympathetic resentment or ultimately spectatorial resentment, the resentment that you feel on behalf of another person when you try to take an impartial perspective in evaluating the case. But even just basic resentment entails some sort of thoughtfulness and reflection about what happened and whether the emotion is a good or right response to what happened. Now, Thumos, I think, or spiritedness of soul, excuse me, even though it's similarly connected to rectifying in injury or sort of supporting justice, I think is, my sense is that Thumos is more proactive than resentment is. Resentment is a response to something, whereas Thumos can often sort of support a proper and just political order before any kind of instigation. And Thumos, especially in, right, as Plato talks about it, is quite hierarchical, which supports a hierarchical conception of justice. Whereas, as we kind of have already discussed, I think sympathetic resentment in particular is this really important part of it, where it reveals this commitment to egalitarianism or equal status, right, of persons, that I'm not sure is evident in the same way in Thumos.
Yeah, good. In thinking about, you know, who resentment motivates in a liberal society, and your preferred liberal society, I was wondering about this, just to sort of drill down into this as well. I can understand the argument that's you know, something like we want to motivate citizens via resentment, because they can get it, that can motivate them to get out on the streets and protest or vote and so forth and exercise civic activity, or even political leaders in order to act for the downtrodden. But I was wondering about say like judges, or judges. Do you think judges, is there a role for judges in sort of being motivated by resentment? And I guess that question, you know, it sort of leads me to the broader point, which is maybe just the version of what I asked you before with a different kind of cast. Is there some tension between the passion of resentment and the rule of law, right? If you have a judge who's motivated by resentment, that might be a problem for following the rule of law. So is there a tension? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great and really central question, right, to this, to thinking about how resentment might be beneficial for liberalism rather than antagonistic. And I think liberals, including myself, but liberals of all stripes, liberals in particular see the proper role of judges as impartial interpreters of the law rather than activists, right? would be deeply disturbed by the notion that judges, when they put on their judge hat, so to speak, are motivated by resentment, would be deeply concerned, because what you would want instead is a commitment fundamentally to a rule of law and equal and impartial administration of the law, rather than judges in their capacity as judges reflecting on whether they agree with something or don't, or how they feel about the law per se, right? So instead, what you would hope for in terms of the judiciary is impartial interpreting of the law rather than a motivation by resentment or something like that. In distinction to, as you brought up, right, the role that I think either politicians or individual citizens can play when they reflect on the law, they reflect on social circumstances and try to consider sort of whether there is injustice, what kind of injustice exists, what might be done about it, et cetera. So I think actually in contrast that sympathetic resentment can and should support the rule of law and equal application when it's done through proper reflection, sort of essentially when individual citizens or when politicians think about injuries that are done or try to sympathetically reflect about circumstances and think about whether there was injury, what kind of injury, and then what should be done about it. Usually the what should be done about it, part of that reflection entails a proportionate response that is an application of the law. I think the tension that you really bring out so nicely in your question comes a lot from the tendency of these two motives, sort of a commitment to the liberal rule of law, or commitment to the rule of law, really, and resentment to go to extremes, right? Which are, I think those extremes are inconsistent and neither of them are preferable, right? So on the one hand, if you have something like resentment devolving into vigilante justice or the pursuit of individual resentments and punishment of them, then that's something like vigilante justice, clearly inconsistent with the rule of law and bad. And on the other hand, if you have something like pure legalism, right? Or unreflective commitment to the law, whether or not it's in line with justice, ultimately, then you would also think that would be inconsistent with sympathetic resentment and probably bad for a liberal view of justice overall, too.
That's great. Yeah. So let's get into the historical account that you give and to the different thinkers to sort of develop this out more. So you're survey three different thinkers, Bishop, Butler, Hume, and Smith, all part of the Anglo tradition. Could you say a little bit about why you picked this particular group of thinkers? Why these three and not say like the French or American tradition?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's admittedly a little odd to turn to the 18th century to thinkers who are not, self-proclaimed liberals. That term obviously doesn't come into use until the 19th century as it is. And to those thinkers, rather than say rationalists in the 19th century or perhaps French liberals in the 19th century. But the reason I turn to these three thinkers who are parts of, even though Butler is an Anglican bishop, that they're all sort of key thinkers in this intellectual movement called the Scottish Enlightenment, is this special combination of a commitment to liberal justice, as I defined it, and something called moral sentimentalism, right? The idea that the information that we have about moral values or what counts as moral comes from our passions and sentiments about things, and ultimately actually the way that we form moral judgments about the world is based on these emotional reactions. Another thing that comes along with this moral sentimentalism tradition in the Scottish Enlightenment is the development of the faculty of sympathy, something that we would usually call empathy today, right? The ability to put oneself in someone else's shoes and think about ideally how that person is feeling in those circumstances, or how that person is reacting, and whether or not it's appropriate. But that's kind of the key, I'd say, intellectual contribution of the Scottish Enlightenment. And that comes alongside this development of a distinctively or recognizably, I think, liberal conception of justice with these thinkers. Now, I don't want to suggest that there aren't other thinkers in the American or French tradition who touch on those topics, or who have quite important arguments to make about the role of resentment or its connection to justice, including some who are influenced by this tradition, right? So James Wilson, who is a sort of more obscure founding father, to the extent that we still want to use that term, was a Scottish emigre, studied with John Witherspoon at Princeton, right? And had a moral sense kind of view of the world that influences his political thought. But I think that we get this more comprehensively in the 18th century. I also think, to some extent, that 19th century French liberalism focuses a little bit more on rationalism, or is interestingly, in different ways, skeptical of equality. In a way, again, I think that this strand of Scottish sentimentalism isn't. So, for example, someone like Tocqueville, right? To the extent that we want to call him a 19th century French liberal, would not have the same views, would not see the same value in a kind of resentment that that reveals a commitment to equality that some of these thinkers do.
I don't know if you want to say a little bit about set the stage for these thinkers in a certain way, so contextualize them. I mean, the case for sentimentalism, it's interesting the way you bring it out. I mean, it's a version of a kind of familiar story about the early modern tradition that sees the passions as in some ways destructive to social and political order, and turns to reason in order to rectify the passions, which tend to be egoistic. And so these thinkers sort of bring out the social character of the emotions in some ways, that they can be harmful but also beneficial in some ways. So, and if you were to say a little bit more about that, you know, setting the stage, I guess, as it were, and about any kind of transition figures. You talk a little bit about Grotius and Pufendorf, but sort of set the stage for us for your three main thinkers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what the first substantive chapter of the book is really devoted to, is like, where did these ideas sort of come from? They didn't emerge de novo. And so how were thinkers in the 17th century and beginning of the 18th century treating the passions? What did they think of them? Were they seen as sort of pro-social motives, as you were talking about, or support for egoism? Really, a lot of these figures, including Grotius and Pufendorf, and then definitely in the 18th century with Hume and Smith and Butler, explicitly responding to egoists of the 17th century, like Spinoza, and especially Hobbes, who's kind of focus for a lot of these thinkers. And so Pufendorf and Grotius, these natural law thinkers in the 17th century, really set the stage, I think, for the Scots to develop empathy on the one hand. They're the first thinkers in this time period to focus on how emotions can kind of reveal equality or really equal dignity. Pufendorf has some, I think, still to this point, kind of relatively unexplored ideas about equal dignity that end up becoming influential later, that I talk about in the first chapter. And they are the first, these natural law thinkers really start to connect resentment to justice, especially through the punishment of wrongs, right? So that's obviously a big focus for Grotius, whose whole project is trying to figure out a way to defend just wars, right, or to defend invasion, especially the Dutch invasion of various countries as just. And so he's coming up with an account of when legal punishment is justified. That's kind of central to his project, along with developing when wars might be just. So the critical thing about those two natural law thinkers is, in contrast to Hobbes and Spinoza, they assume from the get-go sociability, that human beings simply are social creatures, and that they have some set of mental faculties that allow them to live together well. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they think this sociability always goes off without a hitch, or that we can be sociable in large, diverse societies, which is really a key problem for a lot of these thinkers. And so they try to work out, in this case, how the natural law might actually reveal a way for us to be to live together well in large and diverse societies. So that's, to summarize kind of that, I think they pave the way for a focus on equal dignity is emerging from these emotions. They start to see resentment as connected to justice, and they sort of emphatically say that we are social beings against the egoistic tradition. At the same time, they are all very concerned, the natural law thinkers, with the excesses of resentment, with the connection between resentment and vengeance. And for that reason, they ultimately put faith in reason as the faculty that's going to reveal our duties, right? Or the duties, the natural law itself, right? So how can we live together in large, diverse societies? Well, we just need to actually reason about these things, rationally reflect to see what the natural law might dictate. You didn't mention this, but in the first chapter, I also talk about Bernard Mandeville. He's really an interesting, fascinating figure in general, but especially, I mean, in this conversation, because his account is not so straightforward, right? On the one hand, Mandeville thinks that we are capable of living well in large, diverse societies, but that we are sociable. But the reason that we're sociable is because of vicious passions. So things that he explicitly wants us to recognize as vice, that he thinks people are often unwilling to, right? That those are the kinds of things like pride and selfishness that actually in the aggregate do lead to good social effects, right? And so Mandeville, I think, in a really important way, sets the stage for something like emergent social theories in the 18th century. But with respect to resentment in particular, why he isn't part of the Butler Hume Smith story that I'm trying to tell is he sees indignation, he talks about indignation rather than resentment as actually too honest an emotion, or too sort of connected to an interest in doing what we think is the right thing to be socially productive. He thinks it's actually socially counterproductive, because if we're so focused on doing the right thing, we're going to prevent ourselves from doing all those bad things that actually have great social consequences.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about a different, I was just looking in the index to see, I think you do talk about Shaftesbury a little bit, because I was going to ask about Shaftesbury, who seems to be another figure in this tradition, mm-hmm. Critic of this sort of Hobbesian egoism, rationalist tradition, sort of precursor to some of these moral sense views. I'm one of the things that occurred to me, and I mean, you can speak to Shaftesbury if you want, but I guess one of the reasons I raise him is because I wonder if there's a kind of an aesthetic element to this too, because Shaftesbury is a theorist of the beautiful and the sublime, and one of the I think characteristics of the Scottish Enlightenment is that it sort of has this strong interest in art and beauty and so forth, and I just want what. That, of course, has a kind of social component, right? There's a sociability that's around shared experiences of beauty. And there's, a way in which, certainly when you get to Burke is interested in the sort of, beautiful character of political regimes. So I don't know if you had any thoughts about, Shaftesbury and how sort of aesthetics play into the character of this emerging social reaction.
Yeah, I think you're, I mean, that's, Shaftesbury is off, is obviously another huge influence, especially on Hume and Smith and the kind of account of both moral sentimentalism, though not moral sense theory. Both Hume and Smith reject something like this sixth moral sense that that Shaftesbury and Hutcheson, another early, Irish thinker, but early figure in the Scottish Enlightenment, develop as evidence for altruism and benevolence. But the importance of aesthetics, as you point out, in their moral, especially their moral and to some extent their political theories, I think is pretty evident too. So Smith more famously than Hume or Butler, really, I don't think talks about it quite as much, or aesthetics doesn't play quite the same role for, does talk a lot about the beauty of order and the kind of effect that that has on us. I think what's interesting is how that aesthetic appreciation for political order can play with or goes hand in hand with a development of an account of justice or a theory of justice that's based on a pretty ugly emotion like resentment, and one that actually leads to, as I'm sure we'll talk about when we talk about Smith more explicitly, disorder and lots of disharmony.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine it's a kind of aversion to ugliness, right? That's underneath the sort of resentment. So yeah, that's interesting. Right. So let's talk about Butler, who is a not an extensively studied political theorist, maybe it's safe to say. So maybe you could just say a little bit about Butler and what you take to be his contribution to the theory of resentment.
Yeah, absolutely. Butler is definitely an obscure character today, but really fascinating, I think, as a player in the development of the story of how resentment plays a role in politics. He was, as I said already, an Anglican bishop in England in the 18th century. Interestingly enough, widely read by 19th century utilitarians because of his a particular account of ethics, and known for his analogy of religion. Much of the work that I do in the book focuses on his sermons from Rolls Chapel, which is where he talks more explicitly about his ethics. But his view of religion, really defense of God and arguments against deism come from the analogy of religion, where he puts forward an interesting naturalistic account of God, interesting for sort of an Anglican bishop. And that really drives a lot of what Butler is trying to do, is this, he wants to have his cake and eat it too, I guess, in some ways. He's a committed theologian and believer, and yet also wants to show how this is in line with his faith, I guess, is in line with a naturalistic view of God and morality. So in some ways actually related to, or in lots of ways, I should say, related to Shaftesbury on that front too, though he takes a quite different account of why we can tell that God is good, right? That there's a providential account of God based on how he's set us up, what the order of the world looks like. And he is, aside from his work on religion and his role as a bishop, he's enormously influential in the Scottish Enlightenment because of his writings in the sermons, his account of conscience, his development of something like a prototype of sympathy, or again, our contemporary understanding of empathy, and this notion that conscience becomes a superior moral guide. This ends up influencing especially Hume and Smith quite a bit. So the contribution that I really see Butler is making, or his primary contribution, is on resentment. Is actually, he is the first that I think that identifies resentment as an innocent motive and really the paradigmatic social motive, which is to say the motive that enables us to be sociable creatures. Because we have resentment, we can be sociable for Butler in a way that, again, you don't see in any of the 17th century thinkers or 18th century thinkers that I start the book with. And for Butler, this is true because resentment is actually something that's consistent, interestingly enough, consistent with a Christian love of duty, or with a commitment to love thy neighbor and to forgive, kind of the other side of it, that makes him a really interesting political and moral thinker.
Yeah, good. I mean, that's, I guess, the last thing you said just is sort of maybe brings out the paradox for me about him. I mean, so you have, this is a religious figure in Christian tradition, and at least I would expect him to prioritize love as the primary social emotion, right? But yet instead you have resentment. So maybe you could sort of maybe explain that to me. Why is it that he doesn't place love before resentment?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, Butler's key interlocutor in the sermons is Hobbes. He starts off explicitly with a sort of rejection of egoism, and explains that what he's going to do is explain why egoism isn't correct and why we shouldn't all be Hobbesians. And ultimately, why I think he's an interesting figure, and why he puts his eggs in the resentment basket rather than the love basket, is he tends to agree with Hobbes in some ways that self-concern predominates over altruistic concerns, which isn't to say that we don't have a concern for others or that we can't be motivated by a concern for others, but fundamentally we tend to be driven by our passions and our emotions that we feel from our own perspective. So he thinks that, I think, harnessing those, right? Harnessing the emotions, these strong emotions that we feel that might be linked to egoism, but actually he thinks can be revelatory of altruistic commitments, is a much better and more, a much more stable way, I guess, to set up a theory of justice.
I see, yeah. I mean, because I would expect in some ways, you know, one might make a move that, you know, love might be an appropriate relationship for a small community or for a religious mm-hmm. community, but these big modern communities that we're sort of starting to see and develop, it's inappropriate or difficult to achieve a kind of relationship of love, and instead you have to rely on these, you know, darker emotions, and in some ways try to channel them towards the good. Does he make a move like that, or is that sort of an imposition on my part?
No, I think it's sort of assumed when he's talking about societies and this commitment to a common bond that he thinks resentment reveals, that it is a common bond in a society that happens to be large and diverse, not sort of more tribal commitments. He actually thinks resentment reveals that rather than love. But ultimately, I think it's not necessarily that love is a rosier passion or sort of less dark passion, but rather that resentment is more strongly felt. It's just easier or more reliable, right, to base a commitment to altruistic ends of various types, right, to a common bond with others, on getting mad on their behalf, which we feel really strongly, rather than telling us to love them and to extend love in a way that I think he thinks is difficult. And also, again, interestingly, he thinks that adopting the resentments of others is actually a way of being a good Christian, right? Of upholding our Christian duty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So justice is easier than love.
Right. It is in some weird way. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, I can see a case for that. Yeah. Good. Yeah. So let's talk about, I mean, moving from Butler to Hume, who's the next figure that you take up in the book. You could say a little bit about, you know, what's missing from Butler, and what the need is to turn to Hume, and then we can, you know, more squarely address his theory of justice.
Yeah, I think there are a number of things that are missing from Butler. Pretty obviously, there's very little political theory proper. As I mentioned, the sermons are sermons from Rolls Chapel are exactly that. They're sermons on various topics of what it means to be a good Christian. So upon resentment and the forgiveness of injuries, there are two sermons on that. But there is very little on something like what the best regime is or what his theory of justice is, understood as a political virtue rather than a moral virtue. So he doesn't connect the dots, so to speak. There's little in terms of thinking through what his argument for resentment is and then connecting it to something like a political account of justice. He also doesn't, as a number of commentators on Butler, perhaps all of the commentators on Butler, there aren't very many, have pointed out that he doesn't do a lot to connect the dots in terms of thinking about the deliberative process. So he, as I said already, distinguishes anger from resentment and says one is sudden, the other is deliberate, and deliberate resentment is going to get us this wonderful sort of indignation against cruelty and injustice, commitment to the common bonds. But he doesn't explain what that reflective or deliberative process would look like. What the sympathetic process would look like. You might say that Hume and Smith really will develop. And then finally, he doesn't explain any of the implications that resentment might have in terms of our relatively equal status or equal recognition. So there's nothing like, it really is a commitment to a common bond or a commitment to society, but he doesn't really think through what that commitment might mean or what feeling resentment on others' behalves might mean in terms of our position about the status of others.
Yeah, good. So in Hume, I mean, you take up the challenge of the virtue of justice in his treatise on human nature, where he puts this most explicitly, but roughly the idea is that justice is an artificial virtue, not a natural virtue. So not a natural virtue like benevolence or something that just springs spontaneously from us, but something that we have to construct. And so it raises the question about how to motivate individuals to act justly. And so this is, this is a challenge in the literature about Hume, exactly what this would look like. And so the way you developed this chapter is interesting, that the motivational gap is bridged by sympathetic resentment, if I understood you right. So maybe you could just sort of walk us through that. You could say more about the problem of justice if you want, but how it is that Hume's view that sympathetic resentment can motivate us to act justly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Hume is probably the most interesting, well, for many different reasons, and I say this as someone who ultimately does far more work on Smith and sees a lot of value in Smith's moral theory. I think Hume is definitely the most interesting moral sentimentalism, in part because of some of these tensions in his thought. As you're saying, if we understand moral sentimentalism is saying there are sort of emotions and passions give us immediate moral information and they can tell us, they can motivate different virtues, then the fact that there is no affective basis for justice, according to Hume, right? That's what he means by the fact that justice is an artificial and not a natural virtue, that it supposedly has no natural or original affective basis, seems like a pretty big way that he diverges from the moral sentimentalism tradition. And essentially what I think is that I think that the read, especially of his Treatise of Human Nature, where he famously develops that artificial account of justice that says that there is no natural motive is not quite right. I think in fact, Hume explicitly names a natural affective motive for justice. He calls it alternatively the sense of common interest or a common sense of interest. Russell Hardin and other commentators refer to it as kind of trust, right? The idea, the glue in the social fabric or the thing that gets us to want to create laws or rules of justice to order a society. But the question Behind that is really, where does that sense of trust or where does our affective connection to other people come from? And I think that's the thing that sympathetic resentment answers for Hume. I think sympathetic resentment is the thing that makes us feel the disadvantages of defection or the violation of habitually established social trust. And it's also the thing that reveals, and this is Hume's original contribution in this to this debate, I think, is that it really is the thing that reveals a recognition of others' equal status, right? That's implied in this treatment of them as subjects of injustice. That the minute that I can consider another person as a subject of justice, then I've sort of recognize them as an equal in a really important way morally.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's resentment of the free rider, right? I mean, this is one right. of Hume's concerns with the development of justice, like the naive who acts in a self-interested way. So it's resentment of the free rider, and we resent the free rider. Why in particular? Because it's the free rider harms me, my self-love, or because I have a kind of sympathetic identification with the community that the knave would violate?
Or I resent the problem with the free rider, or his sensible knave, or Hobbes's fool, right? This the perennial character in the history of political thought that doesn't really see the value of justice, right? That in fact, they think they should just pursue self-interest as long as they can get away with it, is that that person is fundamentally, as Hume says at the end of the inquiry concerning the principles of morals, you kind of can't convince this person because they're missing that ability to sympathize with others and to recognize, to internalize the fact that what they're doing is wrong. So they're missing the ability to realize that other people will resent them for their injuries and will want to see them duly punished. So the role of the knave, I think, is illustrative because it shows what's happening when you fundamentally don't have that capacity for sympathy broadly, but also in particular, the ability to sympathize with the resentments of others or see how others might resent you.
Yeah, that's good. And, you know, Hume was also attentive to the problems of resentment too. This is a great part of your chapter in which you sort of draw on the history of England, his great work on that to sort of bring out the litany of ways in which resentment has caused such enormous problems in British history, right? That, yeah, I mean, because we've already brought up, you know, in certain ways that resentment is prone to bias, prone to partiality, right? It's our sympathy extends more powerfully to people who are like us rather than those distant from us. I'm reminded of this because I had Sam Fleischacker on it several episodes ago. We talked about, you know, a case for Smithian empathy. And we were talking about Paul Bloom's book is the Yale psychologist. It's an argument against empathy. And you think, how could you be against empathy or sympathy? It's like, well, because part of the problem is that our passions can be easily manipulated, right? And they can be limited and biased and channeled towards just those who are part of our kin group or our in group. So in any case, how does Hume address this? Or how, you know, maybe you could give us some examples of what where he sees the problems here.
Yeah, I think I'm glad you enjoyed those sections on the history of England. I think the volumes on the Tudor dynasty in the history of England are really just brilliant. They're very, sometimes in true Humean fashion, unintentionally funny, sometimes intentionally funny. And, you know, he has takes of historical figures that are familiar to us, but either criticisms of them that are familiar, but for very different reasons or arguments in support of them for very different reasons. So I think with respect to unchecked resentment, which there are examples of historical figures and parties led by unchecked resentment really throughout the history, but again, kind of the Tudor volumes are the best examples. I think maybe the best single example in a person is Henry VIII, right? Who's generally not looked on favorably by history, but Hume's particular take is a bit different there. You know, he thinks rather than a sort of criticism of him being irreligious or causing political instability because of his lust and many wives and what have you, that his problem, Henry's fundamental problem, is he misses this great opportunity and squanders this hard-won peace between various factions, the Lancaster and York families, after the long and terrible War of the Roses, only because he decides to pursue petty partial resentments, right, on behalf of the Lancasters or the Tudors who sort of are the inheritors of that faction, and decides immediately after his coronation to start punishing adherents of the York family. He passes acts of attainder against them, really for no other reason, just because they were members of the York family, to try to punish them. And this begins what ends up becoming a very tumultuous reign, right, for Henry. So I think Hume is great on that because he shows how someone who is led by resentment, which he that is one of the passions that he names as sort of most characteristic of Henry, makes these terrible political decisions even before he gets sort of down the road into his religious or marital problems. Another great example is not of a person, but sort of the political instability that's the result of various factions, and factions are a huge problem for Hume. In fact, there's been a lot on how Hume influences Madison in that respect, right, in the American tradition. But in again, during the Tudor period, basically Hume thinks that most of the religious persecutions during the 17th century and the various civil wars and the interregnum are the results of almost directly of religious resentments. So that's what drives support for Charles II long after Charles I has been killed, and resentment against the commons by the loyalists that effectively reduce them to subjection. So it's the inherent in that, what nearly century long, party dispute that led to this incredibly bloody period in British history is really religious resentment, sort of knee-jerk, partial religious resentments, right? So Hume sees a lot to be concerned about, as you pointed out, I think, in our tribal or partial or party resentments.
Yeah, and I mean, how does he sort of propose to overcome those? I mean, in some ways, it's an appeal back to reflection and reason, right? I mean, this is, I guess, the old rationalist reply is that you need reason after all in order to, it's like the, Plato's tripartite soul, like, Michelle, resentment is good and all, but you still need reason in order to guide things, right? Is that Hume's view, or is it more complicated than that?
Right, or like, it's right, the Platonic view isn't that Thumos isn't important, it's just that it has a proper role in this hierarchy, and that is not at the top of the pecking order. I think you point out something nice, which is people often misunderstand Hume when they think of the most famous quote from his works, right, that reason is and ought to be a slave of the passions, and they take it that means reason plays no role in his moral or political theory, and that is emphatically false. Actually, the role that reason has to play is in helping us understand what the proper means are to achieve ends that are identified by desire. That's what Hume means by that sentence, that reason is not to be a slave of the passions. Not that it doesn't matter, we should simply be ruled by our passions, but rather that there is an appropriate role for reason, and that is not at the head of the, not at the reins all of the time. So I think for Hume and for other Scots, the way that he would respond to the rationalist critique is, of course, there is a role for reason and especially reflection, right, in deliberation about these things, including in determining how you might best realize the ends that have been identified by or been motivated by emotions, right? So in the particular instance of how we deal with partial resentments, I think Hume is ever the institutionalist. His goal is in trying to find some sort of constitutional means or reasonable means, right, to prevent the kinds of worst partial resentments from destabilizing politics. So he thinks that certain kinds of political parties should not be allowed to be established, like those based on material principles or sort of wealth or connection to a royal family. He thinks those are just much more likely to inflame partiality in a problematic way. And he is a big advocate, and again, you see this in the discussion of the 17th century period in England. He's a big advocate for institutionalizing toleration. And so those are the ways that he thinks you can overcome some of the difficulties associated with partial resentments without losing or without trying to get rid of the emotions wholesale.
Adam Smith is the final thinker you take up, and I take it in your view you think gives the deepest account. Is that right, of resentment?
Yeah. Think most, I would say, the sort of most psychologically complex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. So maybe you could bring out those sort of psychological underpinnings of it. I mean, in some ways, your chapter seemed to me sort of worked on two different tracks. One was on the track of sort of psychological, but on the other hand, Smith returns in some ways to Butler's approach, which is to see a kind of providential ordering of things. Now you complicate that in the story, but part of what Smith is after is a worry about the recognition of this emotion of resentment and that nature bequeaths unto us. And, you know, it seems to cause so much destruction. So, can we make a case that nature had created this in human beings? So maybe you could just sort of walk us through some of the sort of psychological account he gives and how he thinks about it in the context of human nature.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the two tracks description is really nice, because Smith sees the highs and lows of resentment, I think, at the same time, better than any of the other figures in the book. You know, he calls it the pillar of justice. It's the emotion that supports our, basically supports the fabric of society for Smith. It's an inherent thing that we have a natural sense of justice. He emphatically sort of argues against Hume that we don't have to worry about, you know, a vague kind of description of the development of a sense of common interest or trust. We just have inherent in this natural rejection of vice, he thinks. And we are able to channel this fundamentally through sympathy, that supports justice. On the other hand, he really describes in detail what the phenomenological experience of resentment is like, right? From the perspective of both the victim of injury and from the perspective of sympathizers, third party observers who try to enter into the emotions of other people. And what he tells us is that it's not a fun experience, right? That when you've been injured and when you are injured as a victim and you have to not only deal with the injury, but the psychological experience of feeling resentment against that and trying to get other people to identify with that resentment, that is quite hard. That is psychologically disordering. It is a tumultuous passion. And similarly for third party observers from a third person perspective, you might say, that it's the same thing. It's not a pleasant emotion to experience on behalf of someone else. And so we, in fact, try to resist it, which is why we're so, one of the good things about sympathetic resentment, the kind of perspectival distance that we get from it and our resistance to engaging in it with means that we're going to be much more impartial in our adoption of others' resentments than we might be on our own behalf. But the problem with that disordering psychological process, aside from just the fact that it's unpleasant or throws our minds into a little bit of disorder is often in the world that we live in, right? In the real world, we're not really able to rid ourselves of that resentment in the way that we would be if we lived in a perfectly just one. And so what Smith talks about, right, is the fact that even in the best of circumstances, what he calls the most with the well-administered of states, there's often injustice that goes unpunished. And so that means there are often people, either victims or third person observers, who still have a kind of lingering and unsatisfied resentment because they didn't see proportionate punishment done. They didn't see a kind of exact justice, which is really what the natural emotion of resentment calls out for. And then that can lead to lingering psychological discord and emotional problems.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you connect this with, you know, the broader, I guess, interpretive strategy in reading the theory of moral sentiments as a way of thinking about spontaneous order among the emotions, right? One way to read the theory of moral sentiments is Smith is trying to develop a way to bring harmony to our social lives. That nature tends towards that. It tends towards it as evidenced by our sympathetic engagement with other individuals. And one of the things you point out, you know, and you bring out here is that, well, that might be too tidy of a story, that, you know, Smith might not be a theorist of spontaneous order after all in the emotions. But I wonder about that, you know, in this particular context, because you might think that some lingering resentment might be beneficial to nature's ordering, just in the sense that it further promotes the advancement of justice. It would be a poor governor. Nature would be a poor governor if it just simply tidied up our, you know, emotional, our cause for justice, because the world is always going to be unjust. So you constantly need the emotions to tell us that.
Yeah, I think that's actually quite right. I think that can be true at the same time that Smith can rightly describe exactly how troublesome and difficult the emotion is to experience. It can also be true that experience is really useful for continuing to rectify injustice or continuing to sort of improve justice in liberal states, that it makes us anxious to do that and anxious about the order that we live in rather than sort of satiated or unperturbed by it. So you're right that I think that people who read Smith as an uncomplicated theorist of spontaneous order miss precisely not what I would call maybe a reformist project, right? And a real commitment to realizing justice as best as we can in the economic realm, in the political realm, the moral realm in his works.
Yeah, good. So I wanted to turn in closing, because time's running short, but I wanted to ask you a couple questions about the contemporary world and the application of resentment to it. I guess the first question sort of returns us back to your original point about how you sort of conceived of this book before the development of all, you know, the Trump resentment phenomenon, right? That we all have come to realize. So I guess, you know, just to sort of lay my cards on the table, or maybe just to play devil's advocate, I don't know. I haven't thought through this enough, but it seems to me that maybe our problem in our American society is that we have too much resentment, that we have too much moral outrage. I mean, this is why I'm not on Twitter, right? The amount of, you know, sort of resentment and moral grandstand, like we have plenty of motivation about justice. That the problem is that we have that resentment isn't rationally ordered. One would say that that's largely tribal. So that what we need is more of the kind of rationalist tradition and less of the Scottish tradition. I put it in a very blunt way. So what do you think about that?
I appreciate that, because I think that really is the challenge, and it does seem. I think today the knee-jerk reaction of any American, at least when you hear resentment, is to think about racial resentments and racial or perhaps economic resentments to the extent you believe that story associated with the rise of Trumpism or the radical right in the US. And then isn't that just a bad thing? Isn't this just people deciding they've been injured and then resenting people? And so shouldn't we just get away? Isn't the point that we want to reduce that? And I think that part of the problem is that is a, you know, this is the argument of the book, that this is a misappropriation of the term. Those people might be angry, or they might be unreflective about, right, what, not all of them, but some people might be unreflective about what the actual injury is, what happened, why they are resentful, right? So I think that we call all of these things racial resentment, or we call them economic resentments, but actually we abandon this concern with figuring out whether there actually was an injury or an injustice that prompted this supposed resentment, and whether that that response is justified. And for all of the thinkers in this book, that is fundamentally, you know, critical to determining whether you should be resentful, excuse me, and what you should do about it. And I think, I don't want to speculate too much about why I think that's the reason, but why I think we just sort of adopt the resentments of other people, or we sort of unreflectively assume that it's right to call them resentments. But I do think there's a little bit of just relativism is in vogue, and this idea that your experience of things is true, that you don't actually have to think through your emotions, and that calling an emotion right or wrong is very out of vogue in contemporary society. And I think part of my project is to push back against that, right? That what the Scots tell us is, again, not that reason and passions are at odds, but rather that emotions give us really important information about how we experience the world. They motivate us to do things. They connect us to other people, but we can't simply live an irrational emotional life. We have to be reflective about how we interact with things. So I guess I would say really the problem is how we define these kinds of resentment, and we should focus more not on, again, necessarily trying to annihilate them, but identifying what an actual injury was, if there was one. Who is the victim, right? Who is a criminal, if there was a criminal, or who committed the injury? How might those things be rectified? Those are all fundamentally more productive conversations to have, I think, that also lower the political temperature without you know, throwing the baby away with the bathwater, so to speak.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, tell me, this is a fair recapitulation of what you're saying, because in a way, what the Scots are developing is not just a descriptive moral psychology, but like a normative moral psychology. That is, right, that, you know, that they're developing these emotions, but there is a certain telos to the emotions, to their full and true development. And that their full and true development then can be it's a justified form of resentment rather than one that's just sort of disordered. And I mean, this is what we've been talking about. I mean, Hume has a concept, you know, like a disordered soul, the knave or whatever. And, you know, so there's a normative more, and in the contemporary world, we're not sort of, you know, equipped to think in terms that sort of normative or teleological project. As you say, there's sort of a fair bit of relativism about the emotions. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I think, you know, I think one of the challenges, interestingly, I think one of the challenges for moral sentimentalism as a sort of as a set of moral theories is in how they give you a good normative account of morality, how things don't become relativistic. But obviously, or what I think is revealed in my comments is that I think Hume, and especially Smith, has an answer to that, and it's in his development of this idea of propriety, which is this regulative moral standard for him. And so it really, what is important is in thinking through when resentments are justified and when they are not, rather than assuming any resentment is justified or all resentment is vindicated, right? Which is emphatically not what they thought and not what I'm arguing in the book.
Yeah, good. And the last set of questions I had was about, you know, some of the institutional, one particular institutional means that you suggest to sort of combat some of the ill effects of unchecked resentment. You know, one of the things you bring out is about modern commerce, which is sort of absolutely central to the liberal tradition. So I thought maybe you could just say, you know, briefly what the, you know, what the case is. How is it that, you know, commerce can have a potential to, you know, develop resentment in a healthy way? And then I'll suggest ways that maybe that it won't. But yeah, yeah. Go ahead. What's the case first, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, Montesquieu, even though he's not a figure in this book, he obviously influences, is in the background, I would say, a lot. And he puts it nicely right in the Spirit of Laws that commerce cures destructive prejudices, and that one of the great benefits is that it, because you are forced, you have an economic imperative to interact with people in a sort of relatively free commercial society, that you tend to think through, or you have an incentive to think through how other individuals are thinking, what their emotions are, what their circumstances are, and to sympathize with them, basically, right? So that you might actually, as if you interact with them, you might actually be able to adopt some of their different perspectives. It's also true, and Smith makes this argument in Wealth of Nations, right, that part of the difficulty of achieving this impartial perspective, what he calls the impartial spectator, that's so critical to making good moral judgments, to really answering that relativism criticism for to other moral sentimentalist thinkers, is that you have to sample essentially enough diverse others to get an idea of what an actual impartial third person perspective would be, to get outside of the partial resentments that someone like Hume sort of worries about so much, right? And one way you can do that is by experiencing diverse others, and commerce and sort of a global commercial system really, really fundamentally links you with other people, weaves your interests with others' interests in a way that that isolationism, economic isolationism, right, or mercantilism, or non-commercial systems don't.
Right. Yeah. And I've grown more and more convinced by that claim. In part, economic experiments, this dictator game. I don't know if you know this. You know, they played the dictator game, you know, in different cultures, and it turns out that, like, in more, you know, commercial societies, tend to be, there's more of a norm of fairness that gets revealed by these games, in contrast to less commercially developed societies. So, you know, and the account is that the, you know, something roughly what you just gave, which is the sort of development of a commercial society, requires us to engage with a, you know, impersonal kind of community, and selling our wares and buying our wares. And that's an interesting thought. I mean, the thing that I wanted to just push you on finally is the inequality that develops in commercial societies, and the ways in which that inequality leads to resentment. And, you know, I mean, the sort of upper class, you know, is perpetually resentful of the lower class for being lazy, and the lower class is perpetually resentful of the upper class for, you know, stealing their money, essentially. So, yeah. Right. It's like, so what, I mean, it seems at the same time where commercial society might facilitate resentment, it also seems to arouse it. So I'm just trying to, maybe you could speak to that sort of element of inequality there, and how it tends towards sort of more destructive forms of resentment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ultimate question is how much you think the kind of inequality that we have today is endemic to capitalism or commerce versus something like a problematic offshoot of it, or that you can have, you're always going to have some amount of inequality in commercial societies, right? But the question is whether we have extreme, or whether it's necessary that those societies have the kind of extreme inequality that we have today. Because I think, you know, Smith, in fact, himself, argued emphatically against what he calls in a early draft to the Wealth of Nations, oppressive inequality, which is where you have such extreme differences in circumstances and such a poor class and such a sort of rich class of capitalists, the poor effectively become obscure. And that's problematic for a number of reasons, including, I think, that it fosters the kind of resentment among them that you're talking about. But also more problematically from Smith, from a moral perspective, they just fundamentally can't be subjects of sympathy anymore. There's such a wide social gap between the classes that they're not capable of seeing other people as in moral subjects, right? As sympathizing with them in a way that is critical for any of the kind of story that I'm telling to take place. And Dennis Rasmussen has written a lot about that really, really nicely about what Smith's criticism of inequality is and how it can effectively inhibit sympathy. So I think the question really has to be, is there a kind of commerce that can facilitate the beneficial kinds of sympathetic resentment or facilitate sympathy without cutting it off? And that really hinges on how much you think that extreme inequality is a necessary consequence of commercial or capitalist societies versus one that we might remedy, right? Versus one that's actually the result of particular policy decisions or things that aren't necessarily critical elements of commerce or capitalism itself, but rather aberrant sort of developments.
Well, Michelle, this has been so much fun. Great, great conversation. I loved it. So thank you again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Yeah, it's been such a joy to talk about this, and I appreciate even the stronger pushbacks. A lot of your concerns are things, even after working on this for, God, nearly like a decade at this point, I still have to know.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.